bodies, four of them. They all lay dead on the ground, blood in oddly dark color against the grass. It was the day after Vivenna's visit to the Daedonir garden to meet with the forgers. She was back again. Sunlight streamed down hot upon her head and neck as she stood with the rest of the gawking crowd. The silent Daedonir waited in rows behind her, soldiers of stone who would never march. Only they had seen the four men die. People stood around waiting for the city guard to finish their inspection. Danth had brought Vivenna quickly before the bodies could be cleared. He had done so at her request. Now she wished she'd never asked. To her enhanced awakener eyes, the colors of the blood on grass were powerfully distinct, red and green. It made almost a violet in combination. She stared at the corpses, feeling an odd sense of disconnection. Color. So strange to see the colors of skin pale. Vivenna looked away.
You see it?
She nodded silently.
You asked about him. Well, he is what he does. This is why we're so worried. Look at those wounds.
Vivenna turned back. In the growing morning light, she could see something she'd missed before. The skin directly around the sword wounds had been completely drained of color. The wounds themselves had a large black tinge to them, like they had been infected with some terrible disease. She turned back to Danth.
Oh, let's go.
Danth led her away from the crowd.
Who were they?
A gang of thieves. Ones we'd worked with.
You think he might come for us?
I'm not sure. He could probably find us if he wanted. I don't know.
Tong Fa approached across the green as they passed through the Daedonir statues.
Jules and Claude are on alert. None of us see him anywhere.
What happened to the skin of those men?
It's that sword of his. We have to find a way to deal with it, Tonks. We're going to end up crossing him eventually. I can feel it.
We'll have to steal the thing, Danth.
Tong Fa rubbed his chin as Jules and Claude filled in around them, making a protective pattern as they moved out into the human river of the street.
Steal the sword? I'm not touching the thing. No. We have to make him use it. Draw it. He won't be able to keep it out for long, and after that, we'll be able to take him easily. I'll kill him myself.
He beat our steel.
He did not beat our steel. Not in a duel, at least.
Vasha didn't use the sword. There was no blackness around our steel's wounds.
Then Vasha used a trick. Who ambush, accomplices, something. Vasha is no duelist.
Vivenna let herself get pulled along, thinking of those bodies. Danth and the others had spoken of the deaths this Vasha was causing. She wanted to see them. Well, now she had, and it left her feeling disturbed, unsettled, and... Vivenna frowned, itching slightly. Someone with a lot of breath was watching her.
Hey, it's Varatrilides. We should go talk to him. He'll be happy to see me.
Vasha stood openly atop the building. He didn't really care who saw him. He rarely did. An endless flow of people passed on the colorful street. Varatrilides, Danth, as he called himself now, walked among them with his team. The woman, Jules, Tong Fa, as always, the clueless prince, and the abomination.
Is Shashara here? We need to go see her. She'll be worried about what happened to me.
We killed Shashara long ago, Nightblood. Just like we killed Arsteel. Just like we'll eventually kill Danth.
As usual, Nightblood refused to acknowledge Shashara's death.
She made me, you know. Made me to destroy things that were evil. I'm rather good at it. I think she'd be proud of me. We should go talk to her. Show her how well I do my job.
You are good at it. Too good.
Nightblood was obviously content with himself. Vasha ignored the blade's incessant humming and focused on the princess, walking in her obviously exotic dress, standing out like a flake of snow in the tropical heat. He would need to do something about her. Because of her, so many things were falling apart. He didn't know where Danth had found her or how he kept control of her. However, Vasha was sorely tempted to jump down and let Nightblood take her. The deaths the night before had already drawn too much attention. Nightblood was right. Vasha wasn't good at sneaking about. Rumors regarding him were widespread in the city. That was both good and bad.
Later.
A light song? What in the name of the iridescent tones are you doing?
Light Song ignored Blushweaver, instead applying his hands to the clump of muddy clay in front of him. The pottery wheel spun. He held the clay, trying to get it to stay in place. As the wheel sped up, the clay twirled round, flipping out clods and clumps. Light Song's hands became soaked with grimy, slick clay, and it didn't take long for the entire mess to flip off the wheel and squish to the ground.
Have you taken leave of your senses?
Light Song hopped to his feet, holding his hands out to either side as servants rushed to wash them off. Others came and wiped the bits of clay from his fine robes. He stood thoughtfully as other servants removed the pottery wheel.
Well, what was that?
I just discovered that I am no good at pottery. Actually, I am worse than no good. I am pathetic. Ridiculously bad. Can't even get the blasted clay to stay on the wheel.
Well, what did you expect?
I'm not sure.
Light Song walked across the pavilion toward a long table. Blushweaver, obviously annoyed at being led along, followed. Light Song suddenly grabbed 5 lemons off of the table and threw them into the air. He proceeded to juggle them. Blushweaver watched, and for just a moment, she looked honestly concerned.
A Light Song, dear, is everything all right?
I have never practiced juggling. Now, please, grab that guava fruit.
Blushweaver hesitated, then carefully picked up the guava.
Throw it.
She tossed it at him. Light Song deftly plucked it from the air, then threw it into the pattern with the lemons.
I didn't know I could do this. Not before today. What do you make of it? I don't think I've ever seen you at a loss for words, my dear.
I don't know that I've ever seen another god throwing fruit into the air.
It's more than this. Today, I have discovered that I know a surprising number of sailing terms, that I am fantastic at mathematics, and that I have a fairly good eye for sketching. On the other hand, I know nothing about the dyeing industry, horses, or gardening. I have no talent for sculpting. I can't speak any foreign languages, and as you've seen, I'm terrible at pottery.
Blushweaver watched him for a second. Light Song looked at her, letting the lemons drop but snatching the guava out of the air. He tossed it to a servant who began peeling it for him.
My previous life, Blushweaver. These are skills that I, Light Song, have no right to know. Whomever I was before I died, he could juggle. He knew about sailing, and he could sketch.
We are not supposed to worry about the people we were before.
I'm a god, and by Kalad's phantoms, I'll worry about whatever I please.
Oh, just when I thought I had you figured out.
You didn't have me figured out, and neither did I. That's the point. Shall we go?
Blushweaver nodded, joining him as they began to cross the lawn, their servants bringing parasols to shade them.
You can't tell me that you've never wondered.
Oh, my dear, I was boring before.
How do you know?
Because I was an ordinary person. I would have been... Well, have you seen regular women?
Their proportions aren't quite up to your standards, I know. But many are quite attractive.
Oh, please. Why would you want to know about your normal life? What if you were a murderer? Or a rapist? Worse... What if you had bad fashion sense?
You act so shallow. But I see the curiosity. You should try some of these things. Let them tell you a little of who you were. There must have been something special about you for you to have returned.
Light Song stopped as she ran her finger down the front of his chest.
Well, if you're trying new things today, maybe there's something else you ought to think about.
Don't try to change the subject.
I'm not. But how will you know who you were if you don't try? It would be an experiment.
My dear, I fear you would find me less than satisfactory.
I think you overestimate me.
That's impossible.
Blushweaver paused, flushing slightly.
I didn't exactly mean...
Oh, bother. Oh, now you've spoiled the moment. I was about to say something very clever, I just know it.
Both of us at a loss for words in one afternoon. I do believe we're losing our touch.
My touch is perfectly fine, which you'd discover if you'd just let me show you.
Light Song rolled his eyes and continued to walk.
Ugh, you're hopeless.
When all else fails,
use sexual innuendo. It always brings the focus back to where it belongs. On me.
Hopeless. But I doubt we have time for me to chastise you again. We've arrived.
Indeed, Hopefinder's Palace was before them. Lavender and silver, it had a pavilion out front prepared with three tables and food. Hopefinder the Just, god of innocence and beauty, stood up as they approached. He appeared to be about 13 years old. By apparent physical age, he was the youngest of the gods in the court, but they weren't supposed to acknowledge such discrepancies. After all, he'd returned when his body had been two, which made him, in God's years, Lightsong's senior by 6 years. In a place where most gods didn't last 20 years, and the average age was probably closer to 10, 6 years' difference was very significant.
Lightsong, Blushweaver, welcome.
Oh, thank you, dear.
Hopefinder nodded, then gestured toward the tables. The three small tables were separate, but set close enough together for the meal to remain intimate while giving each god his or her own space.
How have you been, Hopefinder?
Very well. There was a particularly difficult case during petitions this morning. A mother with a child who was dying of the fevers. She'd already lost her other three, as well as her husband, all in the space of a year. Tragic.
My dear, you're not actually considering passing your breath, are you?
I don't know, Blushweaver. I am old. I feel old. Perhaps it is time for me to go. I'm fifth most aged, you know.
Yes, but with the times growing so exciting.
Exciting? Why, they're calming down. The new queen is here, and my sources in the palace say that she's pursuing her duties to produce an heir with great vigor. Stability will soon arrive.
Stability? Hopefinder, I find it hard to believe that you're so uninformed.
You think the Idrians plan to use the new queen in a play for the throne? I know what you've been doing, Blushweaver. I disagree.
And the rumors out in the city? The Idrian agents who are causing such a ruckus? The so-called second princess somewhere in the city?
The city's Idrians are always creating one crisis or another. What was that disturbance 6 months ago? The rebel on the outer dye plantations? He died in prison, I recall. Foreign workers rarely provide a stable societal underclass, but I don't fear them.
They've never claimed to have a royal agent working with them. Things could get out of hand very quickly.
My interests in the city are quite secure. How about yours?
That's what this meeting is for.
Excuse me, but what in the colors are we talking about?
Unrest in the city, Lightsong. Some of the locals are unsettled by the prospect of war.
They could turn dangerous very easily. I think that we should be prepared.
I am.
Hopefinder watched Blushweaver with his too young face. Like all younger returned, the God King included, Hopefinder would continue to age until his body reached maturity. Then he would stop aging. Just over the brink into the prime adulthood until he gave up his breath. He acted so much like an adult. Lightsong hadn't interacted much with children, but some of his attendants, when training, were youths. Hopefinder was not like those. All accounts said that Hopefinder, like other young returned, had matured very quickly during his first year of life, coming to think and speak as an adult while his body was still that of a young child.
He doesn't seem to find Blushweaver's beauty distracting.
Blushweaver turned to the fruit course, acting characteristically lascivious as she sucked on pieces of pineapple. Hopefinder either didn't care or didn't notice as she leaned forward, showing an impressive amount of cleavage.
Something is different about him. He returned when he was a child and acted like one for a very short time. Now he's an adult in some ways, but a child in others. And yet, different gods have different body styles. Blushweaver is inhumanly well endowed, particularly for how thin she is. Yet Mercy Star is plump and curvaceous all around. Others, like Allmother, look physically old. But there have been gods who are fat. There was a time in our culture's history when that was seen as the ideal.
Did returned looks have something to do with the way society saw them? Perhaps their opinion of ideal beauty? That would certainly explain Blushweaver. Some things survived the transformation. Language, skills, and, as he thought about it, social competence. Considering the fact that the gods spent their lives locked up atop a plateau, they probably should have been far less well-adjusted than they were. At the very least, they should have been ignorant and naive. Yet most of them were consummate schemers, sophisticates with a surprisingly good grasp of what happened in the outside world. Memory itself didn't survive. Why? Why could Lightsong juggle and understand the meaning of the word bowsprit, yet at the same time be unable to remember who his parents had been? And who was that face he saw in his dreams? Why had storms and tempests dominated his dreams lately? What was the red panther that had appeared yet again in his nightmares the night before?
Blushweaver, enough. Before we go any further, I must point out that your obvious attempts to seduce me will gain you nothing.
Blushweaver glanced away, looking embarrassed. Lightsong shook himself out of his contemplations.
My dear Hopefinder, she was not trying to seduce you. You must understand, Blushweaver's aura of allure is simply a part of who she is. It's part of what makes her so charming.
Regardless, I will not be swayed by it or by her paranoid arguments and fears.
My contacts do not think that these things are simple paranoia.
Contacts? And just who are these contacts you keep mentioning?
People within the God King's palace itself.
We all have people in the God King's palace.
I don't. Can I have one of yours?
Ugh, my contact is quite important. He hears things, knows things. War is coming.
I don't believe you, but that doesn't really matter now, does it? You're not here to get me to believe you. You just want my army.
Your codes, lifeless security phrases. What will it cost us to get them?
Do you know, Blushweaver, why I find my existence so boring?
Honestly, I still think you're bluffing on that count.
I'm not. 11 years. 11 years of peace. 11 years to grow to sincerely loathe this system of government we have. We all attend the Assembly Court of Judgment. We listen to the arguments. But most of us don't matter. In any given vote, only those with sway in that field have any real say over anything. During war times, those of us with lifeless commands are important. The rest of the time, our opinion rarely matters. You want my lifeless? Be welcome to them. I've had no opportunity to use them in 11 years, and I venture that another 11 will pass without incident. I will give you those commands, Blushweaver. But only in exchange for your vote. You sit on the Council of Social Ills. You have an important vote practically every week. In exchange for my security phrases, you must promise to vote in social matters as I say, from now until one of us dies. Ah, so now you reconsider. I've heard you complain about your duties in court, that you find your votes trivial. Well, it's not so easy to let go of them, is it? Your vote is all the influence you have. It isn't flashy, but it's potent.
It's done. My vote is yours. The terms are acceptable. I swear it in front of your priests and mine, before another god even.
By the colors, she really is serious.
Part of Lightsong had presumed all along that her posturing about the war was just another game. Yet the woman who stared Hopefinder in the eyes was not playing. She sincerely believed that Halandrin was in danger, and she wanted to make certain that the armies were unified and prepared. She cared, and that left him worried. What had he gotten himself into? What if there really was a war? As he watched the interaction of the two gods, he was left chilled by how easily and quickly they dealt with the fate of the Halandrin people.
Who am I to chastise another's lack of piety? I, who don't even believe in my own divinity.
And yet, at that moment, as Hopefinder prepared to release his commands to Blushweaver, Lightsong thought he saw something, like a remembered fragment of a memory. A dream that he might never have dreamed. A shining room, glowing, reflecting light. A room of steel, a prism.
Servants and priests, withdraw.
They retreated, leaving the three gods alone.
The security phrase is, a candle by which to see.
It was the title of a famous poem. Even Lightsong knew it. Blushweaver smiled. Speaking those words to any of Hopefinder's 10,000 lifeless in the barracks would allow her to override their current orders and take complete control of them.
And now I withdraw. There is a vote this evening at the court. You will attend, Blushweaver, and you will cast your vote in favor of the reformist arguments.
With that, he left.
Why do I feel like we've just been manipulated?
We only got manipulated, my dear, if there isn't war. If there is, then we may have just set ourselves up to save the entire court, perhaps the kingdom itself.
How very altruistic of us.
We're like that. So selfless at times, it's painful. Either way, that means we control 2 gods worth of lifeless.
Mine and Hopefinder's?
Actually, I was speaking of Hopefinder's and Mercy Star's. She confided hers to me yesterday, all the while talking about how comforting she found it that you'd taken a personal interest in the incident at her palace. That was very well done, by the way.
No, I didn't know that that would encourage her to release her commands to you. I was just curious.
Curious about a murdered servant?
Actually, yes. The death of a servant of the Returned is quite disconcerting to me, particularly in its proximity to our own palaces.
Blushweaver raised an eyebrow.
Would I lie to you?
Only every time you claim you don't want to sleep with me. Lies, brazen lies.
Innuendo again, my dear.
Of course not. That was quite blatant. Regardless, I know that you are lying about that investigation. What was the real purpose of it?
I don't know, Blushweaver. In all honesty, I'm beginning to wonder if I might have been some kind of officer of the law in my previous life.
Blushweaver frowned.
You know, like City Watch. I was extremely good at interrogating those servants. At least, that's my own humble opinion.
Which we've already established is quite altruistic.
Quite. I think this might explain how I ended up dying in a bold way, giving me my name.
I just always assumed you were found in bed with a much younger woman and her father killed you. Seems far more bold than dying from stab wounds while trying to catch some petty thief.
Your mockery slides right off my altruistic humility.
Ah, indeed.
Either way, I was a sheriff or investigator of some kind. I'll bet that if I ever got my hands on a sword, I'd prove one of the best duelists this city has ever seen.
You're serious?
Dead serious. Dead as a squirrel serious.
What?
Personal joke. But yes, I believe it. Though there's one thing I can't figure out.
And that is?
How juggling lemons fits into it all.
I feel I have to ask you one more time. Do we have to go through with this?
Denth walked with Favenna, Tonk Fa, Jules, and Claude. Parlin had stayed behind at Denth's suggestion. He was worried about the dangers of the meeting and didn't want another body to keep track of.
Yes, we have to go through this. They're my people, Denth.
So? Princess mercenaries are my people, and you don't see me spending that much time with them. They're a smelly, annoying lot.
Not to mention rude.
Denth, I'm their princess. Besides, you yourself said that they were influential.
Their leaders are, and they'd be perfectly happy to meet with you on neutral ground. Going into the slums isn't necessary. The common people, they really aren't all that important.
That is the difference between Halandrans and Idrians. We pay attention to our people.
I'm not Halandran.
Denth let the statement drop as they approached the slums. Vivenna had to admit that as they grew closer, she did feel a little more apprehensive. This slum felt different from the others. Darker, somehow. Something more than just the run-down shops and unrepaired streets. Small groups of men stood on street corners watching her with suspicious eyes. Every once in a while, Vivenna would catch a glimpse of a building with women in very revealing clothing, even for Halandran, hanging about the front. This was a foreign place. Everywhere else in Taetalir, she felt like she didn't fit in. Here, she felt unwelcome, distrusted, even hated. She steeled herself. Somewhere in this place was a group of tired, overworked, frightened Idrians. The threatening atmosphere made her feel even sorrier for her people. She didn't know if they would be much help in trying to sabotage the Halandran war effort, but she did know one thing. She intended to help them.
That look on your face, what's it for?
I'm worried about my people.
They passed a large group of street toughs dressed in black with red armbands, their faces stained and dirtied.
I came to this slum when Parlin and I were searching for a new home. I didn't want to get close, even though I'd heard that rents were cheap. I can't believe that my people are so oppressed that
But they would have to live somewhere in here, surrounded by all of this.
Surrounded by?
Living among prostitutes and gangs, having to walk past such things every day.
Princess, your people don't live among prostitutes and gangs. Your people are the prostitutes and gangs.
Vervenna stopped in the middle of the street.
What?
This is the Idrian quarter of the city. These slums are called the Highlands for colour's sake.
Impossible.
Very possible. I've seen it in cities across the world. Immigrants gather, make a little enclave. That enclave gets conveniently ignored by the rest of the city. When roads are repaired, other places come first. When guards are sent to patrol, they avoid the foreign sections.
The slum becomes its own little world.
Everyone you pass in here is an Idrian.
Danth waved for her to keep walking.
There's a reason your kind have a bad reputation in the rest of the city.
No, no, it's not possible.
Unfortunately, she soon began to see signs. Symbols of Austria placed, unobtrusive by intention, in the corners of windowsills or on doorsteps. People in greys and whites. Mementos of the Highlands in the form of shepherd's caps or wool cloaks. And yet, if they were people of Idris, then they'd been completely corrupted. Colors marred their costumes, not to mention the air of danger and hostility they exuded. And how could any Idrian even think of becoming a prostitute?
I don't understand, Denth. We are a peaceful people. A people of mountain villages. We are open. Friendly.
That kind doesn't last long in a slum. They change or they get beaten down.
I could have forgiven the Halandran for making my people poor. But this? They've made thugs and thieves out of caring shepherds and farmers. They've turned our women into prostitutes and our children to urchins.
Vivenna knew she shouldn't let herself get angry. And yet, she had to grit her teeth and work very, very hard to keep her hair from bleeding to a smoldering red. The images awoke something within her, something she had consistently avoided thinking about.
Halandran has ruined these people. Just as it ruined me by dominating my childhood, by forcing me to honor the obligation to be taken and raped in the name of protecting my country. I hate this city.
They were unseemly thoughts. She couldn't afford to hate Halandran. She had been told that on many occasions. She had trouble lately remembering why. But she succeeded in keeping her hatred and hair under control. A few moments later, Tem joined them and led them the rest of the distance. She had been told they would be meeting in a large park, but Vivenna soon saw that the term park had been used loosely. The plot of land was barren, strewn with garbage and hemmed in by buildings on all sides. Her group stopped at the edge of this dreary garden and waited as Tem went ahead. People had gathered, as Tem had promised. Most were of the same type she had seen earlier, men wearing dark, ominous colors and cynical expressions, cocky street toughs, women in the garb of prostitutes, some worn-down older people. Vivenna forced on a smile. For their benefit, she changed her hair color to yellow, the color of happiness and excitement. Tem soon returned and waved her forward.
Wait! I wanted to talk to the common people before we meet with the leaders.
If you wish.
People of Idris, I've come to offer you comfort and hope.
Very few seemed to pay any attention to her at all.
I know that you've had hard lives, but I want to promise you that the king does care for you and wants to support you. I will find a way to bring you home.
Home? Back to the Highlands?
Vivenna nodded. Several people trailed away. Vivenna watched them go with concern.
Wait! Don't you want to hear me? I bring news from your king.
The people ignored her.
Most of them just wanted confirmation that you were whom you were rumored to be, Your Highness.
Vivenna turned back toward the groups in the garden.
Your lives can get better. I will see you cared for.
Our lives are better already. There's nothing for us in the Highlands. I earn twice as much here as I did back there.
Then why even come to see me?
I told you, Princess. They're patriots. They cling to being Idrian, city Idrians. We stick together, we do. You being here, it means something to them, don't worry. They may seem indifferent, but they'll do anything to get back at the Halandrans.
Tem called them patriots, but all she saw was a group held together by only the eternal pressures of Halandran disdain. She turned, giving up on her speech. These people were not interested in hope or comfort. They only wanted revenge. She could use that, perhaps, but it made her feel dirty, even to consider it. Tem led her and the others down a pathway beaten into the ugly field of weeds and trash. Near the far side of the park, they found a wide structure that was partially a storage shed, partially an open wooden pavilion. She could see the leaders waiting inside. There were three of them, each with his own complement of bodyguards. She had been told of them ahead of time. The leaders wore rich, vibrant Taetalir colors, slumlords. Vanna felt her stomach twist. All three of the men had at least the first heightening. One of them had attained the third. Jules and Claude took their places outside the building, guarding Vivenna's escape route. Vivenna walked in and sat in the last open chair. Denth and Tonk Fa took up protective places behind her. Vivenna regarded the slumlords. All three were variations on the same theme. The one on the left looked most comfortable in his rich clothing. That would be Paxson, the gentleman Idrian, he was called. He'd gotten his money from running brothels. The one on the right looked like he needed a haircut to match his fine garments. That would be Ashu, who was known for running and funding underground fighting leagues where men could watch Idrians box each other to unconsciousness. The one in the center seemed the self-indulgent type. He was sloppy, but in a purposefully relaxed way, perhaps because it was a nice accent to his handsome youthful face. Rira, Tem's employer. Vivenna reminded herself not to put too much stock in any facile interpretation of their appearances. These were dangerous men.
I'm not sure what to say to you. I came to find something that doesn't exist. I was hoping that the people still cared about their heritage.
Rira leaned forward, sloppy clothing out of place compared to the others in the room.
You're our princess, daughter of our king. We care about that.
Kind of.
Don't mind Paxson. Really, princess, we're honored to meet with you, and curious at your intentions in our city. You've been making quite a stir.
You all know that war is coming.
I'm not convinced there will be a war. Not yet.
It is coming, I promise you that. My intentions in this city, therefore, are to make certain that the war goes as well for Idris as possible.
And what would that entail? A royal on the throne of Halandrin?
I just want our people to survive.
A weak middle ground. Wars are fought to be won, Your Highness. The Halandrins have lifeless. Beat them, and they'll just make more. I think that an Idrian military presence in the city would be an absolute necessity if you want to bring our homeland freedom.
Vivenna frowned.
You think to overthrow the city? If you do, what do we get out of it?
Oh, wait. Overthrow the city? Are we sure we want to get involved in that sort of thing again? What of Vahir's failure? We all lost a lot of money in that venture.
Vahir was from Pancal. Not one of us at all. I'm willing to take another risk if there are real royals involved this time.
I didn't say anything about overthrowing the kingdom. I just want to bring the people some hope.
Hope? Who cares about hope? I want commitments. Will titles be handed out? Who gets the trade contracts if Idris wins?
Gentlemen, this is not about seeking personal gain. This is about patriotism.
Of course, of course. But even patriots should earn rewards, am I right?
All three looked at her expectantly.
I will be going now.
Denth, looking surprised, laid a hand on her shoulder.
Are you sure? It took quite a bit of effort to set up this meeting.
I have been willing to work with thugs and thieves, Denth. But seeing these and knowing they're my own people is too hard.
You judge us quickly, Princess. Don't tell me that you didn't expect this.
Expecting something is different from seeing it firsthand, Rira. I expected you three. I didn't expect to see what had happened to our people.
And the five visions. You sweep in here, judge us beneath you, then sweep away. That's not very Idrian of you.
What do you know of being Idrian? Where is your obedience of Ostri?
My father carried me down here from the Highlands, Princess. He died working in the Egley fields. I've pulled myself up by the pain of my scraped, bleeding hands. I've worked very hard to make things better for your people. When Vahir spoke of revolution, I gave him coin to feed his supporters.
You buy breath, and you make prostitutes of housewives.
I live
and I make sure that everyone has enough food. Will you do better for them?
Ravenna's life sense jolted her warning of large groups of people approaching.
Colors! They found us!
Outside, through the garden, she saw something terrible. Purple and yellow uniforms on hulking men with gray faces. Lifeless soldiers. The city watch. Peasants scattered, screaming as the lifeless tromped into the garden, led by a number of uniformed living city guards.
Colors! Run!
What's up?
Tolfa grabbed her arm, towing her out of the building as Denth charged the guards. The slumlords and their people were in disarray as they fled, though the city guard were quickly moving to cut off the exits.
Cowards!
Tungfa pulled Ravenna into a small alleyway across from the garden.
What's going on?
Raid. Shouldn't be too dangerous unless...
The men from the slumlords' groups, feeling trapped, had engaged the lifeless. Ravenna felt a sense of horror watching the terrible gray-faced men wade amongst the swords and daggers, ignoring wounds. The creatures pulled out their weapons and began to attack. Denth moved to defend the mouth of Ravenna's alleyway.
Lord's phantoms!
Tungfa pushed Ravenna ahead of him as they retreated.
Those fools decided to resist. Now we're in trouble.
But how did they find us?
Don't know. Don't care. They might be after you. They might be after those slumlords. I hope we never find out. Keep moving!
Ravenna and Tungfa burst out of the alleyway. There, standing in the street waiting, was a group of five lifeless. The lifeless looked as if they were stone, their expressions eerily grim in the waning light. Tungfa glanced backward, obviously decided that Denth wasn't going to be arriving anytime soon, then resignedly held his hands up and dropped his sword.
I can't take five of them on my own, princess. Not lifeless. We'll have to let them arrest us.
Ravenna slowly held her hands up as well. The lifeless pulled out their weapons.
We surrender?
The creatures charged. Tungfa snatched his sword off the ground.
Run!
Ravenna stumbled to the side as several of the lifeless charged Tungfa. She scrambled away as quickly as she could. Tungfa tried to follow but had to stop to defend himself. Ravenna slowed, glancing back in time to see him ram his dueling blade through the neck of a lifeless. The creature gushed something that was not blood. Three others got around Tungfa, though he did manage to whip his blade to the side, taking one in the back of the leg. It fell to the cobblestones. Two ran toward her. Ravenna dashed away, overwhelmed with terror. Taking the first corner she saw, ducking into an alleyway, she raced for the other end, but in her haste she tripped on her skirt.
Help!
Ravenna scrambled to her feet. Something darkened the other end of the alleyway. A hulking figure with gray skin. Ravenna stopped, then spun. The other two entered the alleyway behind her. She backed against the wall, feeling suddenly cold, shocked.
Oh, stray god of colors, please!
The three lifeless advanced on her, weapons drawn. She looked down. A bit of rope, frayed but still useful, sat in the refuse beside her discarded green skirt. Like everything else, the rope called to her. As if it knew that it could live again. She couldn't sense the lifeless bearing down on her, but ironically she felt as if she could sense the rope, could imagine it, twisting around legs, tying the creatures up. Ravenna glanced back at the lifeless with their inhumanly human eyes. She watched them approach and saw her death reflected in their unfeeling eyes. Ravenna trembled as she grabbed the rope. She knew the mechanics. Her tutors had trained her. She'd need to touch the fallen skirt to drain color out of it.
Come to life.
Nothing happened. She knew the mechanics, but that obviously wasn't enough.
Please, please, save me.
The first lifeless reached her, the one who had cut her off at the far end of the alleyway. The creature leaped over her. She looked up in shock as the creature slammed its weapon into one of the others as they arrived. Ravenna blinked her eyes clear, and only then did she recognize the newcomer. Not Denth, not Tungfa, Claude. He expertly took off the head of his first opponent. Claude blocked an attack from the remaining lifeless guard. Behind, in the mouth of the alleyway, two more appeared. They charged as Claude backed up. firmly planting one foot on either side of Avena, the remaining lifeless guard waited for the other two to approach. Avena trembled. She glanced upward and saw something almost human in Claude's eyes as he raised his sword against the three. It was the first emotion she'd seen in any lifeless: determination. The three attacked. She had assumed in her ignorance back in Idris that lifeless were like decaying skeletons of corpses. She'd imagined them attacking in waves, lacking skill, but having relentless dark power. She'd been wrong. These creatures moved with proficiency and coordination, just as a human might. Claude fended off one attack, then rammed his elbow into the face of a second lifeless. Claude whipped his sword around and took the third lifeless in the leg. One of the others, however, rammed his blade through Claude's stomach. Something clear squirted out of both sides, spraying the venom. Claude brought his weapon around and took off his second head. The lifeless guard's weapon still stuck from Claude's chest. One of the other guards stumbled away, leg bleeding clear blood, and then it fell backward to the ground too. Claude turned toward her, eyes lacking emotion, square jaw and rectangular face set above a thick muscled neck. He began to twitch. He shook his head as if trying to clear his vision. An awful lot of clear liquid was pouring from his torso. He placed one hand against the wall, then slumped to his knees. Avena hesitated, then reached out a hand toward him. Her hand fell on his arm. The skin was cold. The shadow moved on the other side of the alleyway. She looked up, apprehensive, still in shock.
Oh, colors!
Tong Fa ran forward, outfit wet with clear liquid.
She's here! You okay?
Avena nodded dully, only barely aware that she was still holding her skirt in one hand. That meant her legs, all the way up to her thighs, were exposed. She couldn't find it in herself to care, nor did she care that her hair was bleached white. She just stared at Claude, who knelt before her, head bowed, as if worshipping at some strange altar. His weapon slipped from his twitching fingers. His eyes stared forward, glassy. Tong Fa followed her gaze, looking at Claude.
Here, Jewel is not going to be pleased. Come on, we need to get out of here.
He was always gone when Ciri awoke. She lay in the deep, well-stuffed bed, morning light streaming through the window. Ciri could tell from the sunlight that it was nearly noon. She and Suzebron tended to stay up late talking. That was probably a good thing. Some might see that she was getting up later and later each morning and think that it was due to other activities. At first, it had been strange to communicate with the God King. As the days progressed, however, it was feeling more and more natural to her. She found his writing, uncertain, unpracticed letters that explained such interesting thoughts, to be endearing. If he spoke, she suspected that his voice would be kindly. He was so tender. She'd never have expected that. She smiled, sinking back into her pillow, idly wishing for him to still be there when she awoke. She was happy. That also was something she'd never expected from Halandrin. She did miss the Highlands, and her inability to leave the Court of Gods frustrated her, particularly considering the politics. And yet, there were other things, marvelous things. The brilliant colors, the performers, the sheer overwhelming experience of Tae T'leir. And there was the opportunity to speak with Suzebron each night. The way he treated her was different from anything she had previously known. Her brashness had been such a shame and an embarrassment to her family, but Suzebron found it fascinating, even alluring. Ciri smiled again, letting herself dream. However, real life began to intrude. Suzebron was in danger. Real, serious danger. He refused to believe that his priests could bear him any sort of malice or be a threat. That same innocence which made him so appealing was also a terrible liability. But what to do? Nobody else knew of his predicament. There was only one person who could help him. That person, unfortunately, wasn't up to the task. She had ignored her lessons and had come to her fate wholly unprepared.
So what?
Ciri stared at the ceiling. She found it hard to summon her customary shame at having ignored her lessons. She'd made a mistake. How much time was she going to spend moping, annoyed at herself for something done and gone?
All right, enough excuses. I might not have been prepared as well as I should, but I'm here now, and I need to do something, because nobody else will.
Siri climbed out of bed, running fingers through her long hair. She folded her arms, wearing only her shift, pacing. She needed to play their game. Siri searched through her memory, dredging up what scraps she could from her lessons. Politics was about exchanges. It was about giving what you had, or what you implied that you had, in order to gain more. It was like being a merchant. You started with a certain stock, and by the end of the year, you hoped to have increased that stock. Or maybe even have changed it into a completely different and better stock.
Don't make too many waves until you're ready to strike. Don't appear too innocent, but don't appear too smart either. Be average.
Light Song's wisdom had indeed been wise.
Exchanges. What do I have to trade or exchange? Not much.
It would have to do. Siri walked over to the door. As usual, a group of serving women waited outside. Siri's standard ladies moved around her, bringing clothing. Another group of servants, however, moved to tidy the room. Several of these wore brown. As her servants dressed her, she watched one of the girls in brown. At a convenient moment, Siri stepped over, putting a hand on the girl's shoulder.
You're from Pankal.
The girl nodded, surprised.
I have a message I want you to give to Bluefingers. Tell him I have vital information he needs to know. I'd like to trade. Tell him it could change his plans drastically.
My dear queen!
Siri smiled as Light Song waved for her to seat herself in one of his chaise lounge.
You treat me too kindly.
Nonsense. You're my queen. And besides, you remind me of someone whom I was very fond.
And who was that?
I honestly have no idea. I can barely remember her. Grapes?
Siri raised an eyebrow, but she knew by now not to encourage him too much.
Tell me, why do they call you Light Song the Bold?
There is an easy answer to that. It is because of all the gods. Only I am bold enough to act like a complete idiot.
Siri raised an eyebrow.
My station requires true courage. You see, I am normally quite a solemn and boring person. At night, my fondest desire is to sit and compose interminably periphrastic lectures on morality for my priest to read to my followers. Alas, I cannot. Instead, I go out each evening, abandoning didactic theology in favor of something which requires true courage. Spending it with the other gods.
Why does that take courage?
My lady, have you seen how positively tedious they all can be?
No, really. Where did the name come from?
It's a complete misnomer. Obviously, you're intelligent enough to see that. Our names and titles are assigned randomly by a small monkey who has been fed an exceedingly large amount of gin.
Now you're just being silly.
Now? Now. My dear, I am always silly. Please be good enough to retract that statement at once.
Light Song watched as the priests began to file into the arena floor below for this day's round of arguments.
It has to do with death. All men die. Some, however, die in ways that exemplify a particular attribute or emotion. They show a spark of something greater than the rest of mankind. That is what is said to bring us back.
You died showing great bravery, then?
I don't know for sure. Something in my dream suggests that I may have insulted a very large panther. That sounds rather brave, don't you think?
You don't know how you died?
We forget. We awake without memories. I don't even know what work I did.
I suspect that you were a diplomat or a salesman of some sort. Something that required you to talk a lot, but say very little.
Yes.
Light Song seemed unlike himself as he stared down at the priests below.
Yes, no doubt. That was it exactly. Regardless, my dear queen, I have provided a surprise for you this day.
Do I want to be surprised by Light Song?
No need to fear. My surprises rarely cause bodily harm, and never to beautiful queens.
Light Song waved his hand, and an elderly man with an extraordinarily long white beard approached.
This is Hoid, Master Storyteller. I believe you had some questions you wished to ask.
Siri glanced at the priests below.
Shouldn't we be paying attention to the speeches?
Pay attention? Ridiculous. That would be far too responsible of us. We're gods for the color's sake. Or, well, I am. You're close enough. A god in law, one might say. Anyway, do you really want to listen to a bunch of stuffy priests talk about sewage treatment? I thought not. Besides, neither of us have votes pertaining to this issue, so let's spend our time wisely. We never know when we will run out.
Of time? But you're immortal.
Not out of time. Of grapes. I hate listening to storytellers without grapes.
Ciri rolled her eyes. The storyteller waited patiently. As she looked more closely, she could tell that he wasn't quite as old as he seemed at first glance. The beard must be a badge of his profession. And while it didn't appear to be fake, she suspected that it had been bleached. He was really much younger than he wanted to appear. Still, she doubted Light Song would have settled for anyone other than the very best.
A storyteller? What do you know of Halandran history?
Much, my queen.
Tell me of the days before the division between Idris and Halandran.
The man reached into a pocket. He pulled out a handful of sand and began to rub it between his fingers, letting it drop in a soft stream toward the ground.
Her Majesty wishes one of the deep stories from long before. A story before time began.
I wish to know the origins of the Halandran God Kings.
Then we begin in the distant haze.
The storyteller brought up another hand, letting powdery black sand drop from it, mixing with the sand that fell from the first hand.
The first God King of Halandran is ancient. Ancient, yes. Older than kingdoms and cities, older than monarchs and religions. Not older than the mountains, for they were already here. Like the knuckles of the sleeping giants below, they formed this valley, where panthers and flowers both make their home. We speak of just the valley then, a place before it had a name. The people of Chedesh still dominated the world. They sailed the inner sea, coming from the east, and it was they who first discovered this strange land. Their writings are sparse. Their empire long since been taken by the dust, but memory remains. Perhaps you can imagine their surprise upon arriving here. A place with beaches of fine, soft sand, with fruits aplenty, and with strange alien forests. Paradise, they called it. A paradise hidden between the mountains. A land with pleasant rains that never grew cold. A land where succulent fruit grew spontaneously. A land of color, because of the tears of Edgley. The striking flowers of such brilliance that could yield dyes that would hold fast in any cloth. The first returned was born during this time, aboard a ship that was sailing the coast. Returned can now be found in all parts of the world. But the first one, the man whom you call Vo, but we name only by his title, was born here, in the waters of this very bay. He declared the five visions. He died a week later. The men of his ship founded a kingdom upon these beaches, then called Hanald. Before their arrival, all that had existed in these jungles was the people of Pankal. Now, you may wonder why I must travel back so far. Should I not speak of the many war, of the shattering of kingdoms, of the five scholars, of Kalad the usurper and his phantom army, which some say still hides in these jungles, waiting? Those are the events we focus upon, the ones men know the best. To speak only of them, however, is to ignore the history of 300 years that led up to them. Would there have been a many war without knowledge of the returned? It was a returned, after all, who predicted the war and prompted Strifelover to attack the kingdoms across the mountains.
Strifelover?
Yes, Your Majesty. Strifelover. Another name for Kalad the usurper.
That sounds like the name of a returned.
Indeed. Kalad was returned, as was Peacegiver, the man who overthrew him and founded Halandran. We haven't arrived at that part yet. We are still back in Hanald, the outpost become kingdom founded by the men of the first returned's crew. They were the ones who chose the first returned's wife as their queen, then used the tears of Edgley to create fantastic dyes which sold for untold riches across the world. This soon became a bustling center of trade. The Tears of Edgeley, the source of Halandran wealth. Such small things, so easy to grow here. And yet, this is the only soil where they will live. In other parts of the world, dyes are very difficult to produce, expensive. Some scholars say that the Many War was fought over these flower petals, that the kingdom of the Kuth and Huth were destroyed by little drips of color.
But only some of the scholars say that, storyteller. What do the rest say? Why was the Many War fought in their opinions?
Most agree that the Many War was not only about petals squeezed dry, but a much greater prize. People squeezed dry. You know, perhaps, that the royal family was growing increasingly interested in the process by which breath could be used to bring objects to life. Awakening, it was then first being called. It was a fresh and poorly understood art then. It still is, in many ways. The workings of the souls of men, their power to animate ordinary objects and the dead to life, is something discovered barely 4 centuries ago. A short time by the accounting of gods. The years leading up to the Many War, those were the days of the 5 scholars and the discovery of the new commands. To some, this was a time of great enlightenment and learning. Others call them the darkest days of men. For it was then we learned to best exploit one another. One of the 5 scholars made a discovery. Commands. Methods. The means by which a lifeless could be created from a single breath. This, perhaps, seems a small thing to you. But you must look at the past of this kingdom and its founding. Halandran began with the servants of a returned and was developed by an expansive mercantile effort. It controlled a uniquely lucrative region, which, through the discovery and maintenance of the northern passes, combined with increasingly skillful navigation, was becoming a jewel coveted by the rest of the world. And so the war came. The 5 scholars split, joining different sides. Some kingdoms gained the use of lifeless, while others did not. Some kingdoms had weapons others could only envy. To answer the gods' question, my story claims one other reason for the Many War. The ability to create lifeless so cheaply. Before the discovery of the single breath command, lifeless took 50 breaths to make. Extra soldiers, even a lifeless one, are of limited use if you can gain only 1 for every 50 men you already have. However, being able to create a lifeless with a single breath, 1 for 1, that will double your troops, and half of them won't need to eat. Lifeless are no stronger than living men. They are the same. They are not more skilled than living men. They are the same. However, not having to eat like regular men, that advantage was enormous. Mix that with their ability to ignore pain and never feel fear, and suddenly you had an army that others could not stand against. It was taken even further by Kalad, who was said to have created a new and more powerful type of lifeless, gaining an advantage even more frightening.
What kind of new lifeless?
Nobody remembers, Your Majesty. The records of that time have been lost. Some say they were burned intentionally. Whatever the true nature of Kalad's phantoms, they were frightening and terrible. So much so that even though the details have been lost in time, the phantoms themselves live on in our lore and our curses.
Do they really still exist out there? Like the stories say, an unseen army waiting for Kalad to return and command them again?
Alas, I can tell only stories. As I said, so much from that time is lost to us now.
But we know of the royal family. They broke away because they didn't agree with what Kalad was doing, right? They saw moral problems with using lifeless.
Why, yes. Yes, they did, Your Majesty.
Ciri raised an eyebrow.
Psst! He's lying to you.
Your Grace, I beg your pardon. There are diverging explanations. Why, I am a teller of stories. All stories.
And what do other stories say?
None of them agree, Your Majesty. Your people speak of religious indignation and of treachery by Kalad the Usurper. The Pankal people tell of the royal family working hard to gain powerful lifeless and awakeners, then being surprised when their tools turned against them. In Halandrin, they tell of the royal family aligning themselves with Kalad, making him their general and ignoring the will of the people by seeking war with bloodlust. But time burns away behind us, leaving only ash and memory. That memory passes from mind to mind, then finally to my lips. When all is truth and all are lies, does it matter if some say the royal family sought to create lifeless? Your belief is your own.
Either way, the return took control of Halandrin.
Yes, and they gave it a new name, a variation on the old one. And yet, some still speak regretfully of the royals who left, bearing the blood of the first returned to their highlands.
Blood of the first returned?
Yes, of course. It was his wife, pregnant with his child, who became the first queen of this land. You are his descendant.
Ciri sat back. Lightsong turned. Curious.
But you didn't know this?
Ciri shook her head.
If this fact is known to my people, we do not speak of it.
Lightsong seemed to find that interesting. Ciri smiled, sensing a subtle way to get to the question she really wanted to ask.
That means that the God Kings of Halandrin carried on without the blood of the first returned.
Yes, Your Majesty.
And how many God Kings have there been?
5, Your Majesty, including His Immortal Majesty Lord Susabran, but not including Peacegiver.
5 kings in 300 years?
Yes, Your Majesty. The dynasty of Halandrin was founded at the conclusion of the Many War, the first one gaining his breath and life from Peacegiver himself, who was revered for dispelling Kalad's phantoms and bringing a peaceful end to the Many War. Since that day, each god king has fathered a stillborn son who then returned and took his place.
Wait, how did Peacegiver create a new god king?
Now, there is a story lost in time. How indeed? Breath can be passed from one man to another, but breath, no matter how much, does not make one a god. Legends say that Peacegiver died by granting his breath to his successor. After all, can a god not give his life away to bless another?
Not exactly a sign of mental stability, in my opinion. You don't encourage confidence in our predecessor, storyteller. Besides, even if a god gives away his breath, it doesn't make the recipient divine.
I only tell stories, Your Grace. Peacegiver was no ordinary returned, for he managed to stop the lifeless from rampaging. Indeed, he sent away Kalad's phantoms, which formed the main bulk of the Halandrin army. By doing so, he left his own people powerless. He did so in an effort to bring peace. By then, of course, it was too late for Kuth and Huth. However, the other kingdoms, Pankal, Tedradel, Gis, and Halandrin itself, were brought out of the conflict. Can we not assume more from this god of gods who was able to accomplish so much? Perhaps he did do something unique, as the priests claim. Leave some seed within the god kings of Halandrin, allowing them to pass their power and divinity from father to son.
Heritage which would give them claim to rule. With such an amazing god as their progenitor, they could become god kings. And the only one who could threaten them would be the royal family of Idris, who can apparently trace their line back to the first returned. Another heritage of divinity. Challenger for the rightful rule in Halandrin.
That didn't tell her how the god kings had died, nor did it tell her why some gods, such as the first returned, could bear children while others could not.
They're immortal, correct?
Indeed, Your Majesty. Like all returned, the god kings do not age. Agelessness is a gift for all who reach the fifth heightening.
But why have there been 5 god kings? Why did the first one die?
Why do any returned pass on, Your Majesty?
Because they are loony.
Because they tire. Gods are not like ordinary men. They come back for us, not for themselves. And when they can no longer endure life, they pass on. God kings live only as long as it takes them to produce an heir.
That's commonly known?
Of course it is, Your Majesty. At least, to storytellers and scholars. Each god king has passed from this world shortly after his son and heir was born. It is natural. Once the heir has arrived, the god king grows restless. Each one has sought out an opportunity to use up his breath to benefit the realm. And then they pass on, leaving their people blessed and their heir to rule.
Not exactly the most pleasant thing to inform a newlywed wife, storyteller, that her husband is going to grow bored with life as soon as she bears him a son.
I seek not to be charming, Your Grace. I only tell stories. This one is known to most. I should think that Her Majesty would like to be aware of it as well.
Thank you. It was good of you to speak of it. So there is an official explanation, and it's actually a pretty good one. Theologically, it makes sense that the God Kings would depart once they arrange for a suitable successor. But that doesn't explain how Peacegiver's treasure, that wealth of breath, passes from God King to God King when they have no tongues. And it doesn't explain why a man like Susabron would get tired of life when he seems so excited by it.
The official story would work fine for those who didn't know the God King. It fell flat for Ciri. Susabron would never do such a thing, not now. Yet, would things change if she bore him a son? Would Susabron grow tired of her that easily?
Maybe we should be hoping for old Susabron to pass, my queen. You were forced into all this, I suspect. If Susabron died, you might even be able to go home. No harm done, people healed, new heir on the throne. Everyone is either happy or dead.
Happy or dead. Excuse me, I would like to walk about a bit. Thank you for your storytelling, Hoid.
With that, entourage in tow, she quickly left the pavilion, preferring that Lightsong not see her tears.